Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 28th of September. This is the week of angels. We have the archangels on Monday the 29th, Michael, Gabriel and Raphael. We know the most about them because they are important enough that in Scripture they have names. And then on Thursday the 2nd, it is the Feast of the Guardian Angels. You might call that the other end of the angelic hierarchy, the simple foot soldiers. They are not concerned with the grand strategy of the cosmos, but you might say that their job is even more important because they are here to look after us, to guard and guide you and me. Angels ought to be a glory and encouragement to us. They are how the power of God reaches out to help us in all sorts of ways. There is a temptation, though, for some people to focus on the angels themselves instead of what God is doing through them. All sorts of half-magical superstitions are the result. When you see websites with pictures of figures with wings or lists of which angel belongs to which day of the week, you see the work of people who are wasting their energy in a wrong direction, and they do actual harm because the rest of us see all this superstition and don't want to have anything to do with it, and so we cut ourselves off from the knowledge of the glory. Angels are pure spirit and they are with God. We are not. Let me try a picture of this because I like making pictures and often they help. I am looking out of my window at the sky. Of course, the sky's moods vary. Sometimes it is cloudless, or almost, and the sun blazes down. Sometimes there are ranks and cohorts of clouds marching this way and that, the way clouds do. But there are two states of the sky that are different from these. One of them is when there is no sky at all. Everything is a featureless, uniform grey. You know when you are in a gallery sometimes, and instead of a picture, there is a picture-shaped patch on the wall with a little label saying, borrowed for an exhibition, or removed for cleaning, or whatever. Well, the sky can look like that, removed for cleaning. Come back later and we will have an actual sky for you to look at. But it's really the other state that I'm thinking of when it comes to angels. It's when you look out of the window and the sky is a lid. It clamps us down. It makes the world we live in flat, not three-dimensional. If the no-sky-at-all state is when we have no concept of up as a direction, the sky as a lid is when we know there is an up, but we are cut off from it. We crawl around like ants in the narrow space between the ground and the lid, and it really does feel like crawling. When the sky is particularly heavy, particularly liddish, you almost feel that you need to hunch down when you are walking, not stand up straight. And then, here's the image I've been aiming at, sometimes there's a crack in the sky a mile or two away, and through the crack, sunlight comes streaming. Not much of it, because the crack is narrow, but what there is dazzling by contrast with the greyness of everything else. Dazzling and real. Seeing that crack, I can imagine above it a world of hills and mountains of clouds, marching, rolling, all in the unceasing glare of a sun that never, ever stops shining. And that is the kind of picture I get of angels and us in relation to God. They are like that crack in the sky through which light comes, the light of a world of spirit that sees God. We cannot live where the light comes from. Think of the real sky and the real clouds, and you in an aeroplane looking down at the cloud tops, and you know that out there in the realm of light you would be frozen in no time because it's -40 degrees outside, and dead in seconds because there's no air, and anyway sunburnt very quickly because there's no air to protect you from the burning light of the sun. We are just not suited to what is outside the plane. Here on earth, in our present incarnate state, we are not suited to the realms of light, but sometimes when we need help from the light, the angels come. When I began to learn Greek at school, I found it rather exciting. There was a new alphabet, which is always fun, and in particular there were a few spelling rules which made you feel you were learning something secret and scholarly. For instance, the double G in Greek had a special pronunciation. The word that looked like agelos was really angelos. And there is the name we give angels. It turns out that angelos in Greek is actually the perfectly ordinary word for messenger. When you have news you want to send to someone, you send the message by angel. I have just asked my Hebrew-speaking neighbour, and he says yes, it's the same in Hebrew. Malach means messenger, and it means all kinds of messengers, including messengers from God. So angel is not the name of a being, it's a name of a job. It's not surprising that we should have picked this name, given where we are in the universe, under our lid of cloud. When angels come here, they come here on missions, so naturally we think that that is what angels are. Missioners, messengers. Another thing, the few angels whose names we know, those names are not names either. Just as God has no name but calls himself being or I am, so Michael means nothing but who is like God. Gabriel means strength or power of God, or God is my strength. Raphael means God has healed. There are plenty of nameless angels as well in the Old Testament. When the three boys are thrown into the burning fiery furnace and people look in, they see four figures walking calmly through the flames. When the priest Balaam is going to curse the children of Israel, an angel stands in his way. The ass he is riding sees the angel and stops. Balaam does not see the angel, but beats the ass until it speaks and complains to him. Then the Lord opens his eyes, and he does see the angel. Sees, indeed, because angels are not people with wings. An angel is pure spirit and has no body. I suppose angels give themselves whatever appearance is needed for their mission. Raphael appeared as the young man Azarias. Artists used people with wings as a symbol of intelligent beings with a connection to the things above, and also because they were fun to draw. Let's not be deceived by that. You can't expect to see wings on an angel you pass in the street, just as if you pass a saint in the street you don't expect to see a nice gold halo. It doesn't work like that, and a lot of the mess people get into with their angelic superstition is treating the pictures as if they were reality. Ah, yes, pictures. Well, my favourite picture of an angel is of the Archangel Raphael, God heals, in the story of Tobias. Raphael looks like just an ordinary young man, and as an ordinary young man he accompanies Tobias on his journey from Nineveh to Ecbatana and back. At the very end of the story, when Tobias is safely married and his father Tobit is cured of his blindness, here is what Raphael says to Tobit. God sent me to heal you and your daughter-in-law Sarah. I am Raphael, one of the seven angels who stand ever ready to enter the presence of the glory of the Lord. Now, bless the Lord on earth and give thanks to God. I am about to return to him above who sent me. What Raphael says is a glimpse of the world of spirit we aren't able to see. He is not boasting, just telling the truth. What he is telling us is that there is more to being an angel than just being a messenger and being sent down to earth to do God's will. Raphael's true full-time job is to spend eternity with God, contemplating and praising. So the spiritual world has reality and an activity of its own. I have an etching of Rembrandt's The Angel Leaving the Family of Tobias. I have put a link to the picture in the episode notes, which you will see in the Universalis Podcasts page, and probably also in the various podcast apps. But in case you can't see it, on the left there is the family huddled, Tobit and his wife Anna, Tobias and Sarah, most of them on their knees. There is a little dog who accompanied Tobias on his journey, looking in completely the wrong direction, the way dogs do when you take pictures of them. At the bottom right, there's the donkey Tobias took with him on his travels. And then, at top right, there is the angel himself setting out back to God again. Two bare feet sticking out from a robe, and that's all you can see. It's a lovely inspiration of Rembrandt's, and I can't help thinking what fun he must have had drawing that angel. You can just see him getting a barefoot model to climb a stepladder and balance at the top while the artist draws him from that angle. the ladder rocking alarmingly. Rembrandt saying, "Try to stay on for 2 more minutes while I put some more lines in. Then you can fall off if you want." When we hear Raphael saying, "I am one of the 7 angels," let's not try and give names to all 7 and properties and characteristic of each as if they were Pokemon cards. When Raphael says, "I am about to return to him above," let's not think that angels have to be shaped like people with wings. Instead of all that, let's remember just 3 things. The glory of God. The spirits close to the glory of God. And most of all, that God helps us in all the ways he can. When the lid of the sky is broken and something comes in through the cracks, that something that comes in is light. The universe is on our side. The universe is on our side with our guardian angels as well. We are never told in Scripture exactly who they are and how they work. It's as if everyone knows already, so no explanation is needed. The key Raphael and Tobias moment for me where guardian angels are concerned is when Jesus says of the little children, "Their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father who is in heaven." They, like Raphael, seem to be working and contemplating both at the same time. On this feast, let's remember that God does good to us not only through people, but also through spiritual beings. Let's not worship our guardian angel as if he were a mini-god or anything, but if once a year we thank God for our guardian angel, promise the angel to listen to him and ask for help when we need it, and perhaps even apologize a little, we will be doing a good thing. It isn't only angels this week. Every day has its saints. We have St. Jerome on Tuesday. He translated the Bible into Latin so that ordinary people in the Roman world could read it and study it, not just the few scholars who knew Greek. To this day, with many languages, the first version of the Bible comes from translating a successor of Jerome's translation. On Friday, we have some Brazilian martyrs from 1645. On the 6th of July of that year, a band of Dutch Calvinists attacked a church in the middle of Mass and murdered everyone in it. On the 3rd of October, they did much the same, but better, because with the assistance of the Indians this time, they could chop everyone to pieces while they were still alive. It makes one quite nostalgic for the civilized proceedings of Roman martyrdoms. The feast is celebrated only in Brazil, but it ought not to be forgotten. These martyrs were canonized by Pope Francis in 2017, and wherever in the world you are, you will find them mentioned in the About Today page in Universalis. That leaves us with 2 of our greatest saints, Thérèse of Lisieux on Wednesday and Francis of Assisi on Saturday. Francis showed us the freedom that comes from being free of possessions. Thérèse showed us the power that comes from having no power. Funnily enough, it's the strong, powerful men who are often the greatest devotees of Thérèse. You know, the large men that stand by doorways and you feel safe because they are on your side in case bad people come. You would think that they would go for someone like themselves, perhaps St. Michael, the warrior angel, but often it does turn out to be Thérèse and her gentle, obstinate toughness. Perhaps it makes more sense than we think. A bouncer has to be first and foremost a diplomat, because a fight avoided is better than a fight won. And that gets close to the weapons Thérèse used for her lifelong battle and her victory. Francis and the Franciscans are a puzzle, because once you look into it, there are so many contradictions. Whatever else St. Francis was, he was not rational about what he did. He was marvellously drunk on love. It was the time for it. The early Middle Ages were the time of courtly love, love separate from either sex or marriage, but turned into a kind of ritual in which the lover dared impossible tasks to make himself more and more worthy of his lady. The church did not entirely approve, but the fashion was the fashion, and Francis was a very fashionable young man. He devoted his life to daring impossible tasks for his lady, and his lady was poverty. No one with any sense would become a Franciscan, but too much sense itself does not make sense. Our culture has too much of it. It has planning, risk management, prudence. We plan, we calculate, execute, check our key performance indicators, always have a plan B just in case. I know someone who runs his relationships like that too, and when I am puzzled by him saying, I am 80% happy with her, but there's a 40% I could find someone better, he is puzzled by the fact that I am puzzled. Francis could have been cool and level-headed. His father was a successful merchant, and he could have been one too. He could have lived 88 years instead of wearing himself out in 44. But Francis fell in love, went mad with love, threw off all his clothes and started from zero, from perfect poverty, and he transformed the world. If you look in the menus in the Universalis apps and programs, you will see a command called Daily Books. Select it and you will see a list of books. One of them is G.K. Chesterton's book about St. Francis. You can tell Universalis to give it to you in instalments at the end of whatever page you choose, about today, Vespers, whatever you want. Chesterton was a journalist, but in no way a fact hound. I doubt that you'll find more than two dates in the whole book, but he does respond in his poetic way to what St. Francis is all about. You will get closer to Francis through him than through any proper biography. You will find plenty of Francis stories around. Here are two stories about Franciscans. The first occurs in a remote part of the world well within living memory. It concerns a Franciscan community which was supported by their neighbours in the towns and farms. Some farmers supplied them daily with milk, other people gave them other things. One day a band of marauders came to attack the community, not to murder like those Calvinists in Brazil, but to steal whatever they could. One wonders just at what point they discovered that the Franciscan community is not really the best kind of place to rob. Anyway, the neighbours banded together and drove them off, not without loss of life. Sometime later, someone delivering milk to the friars saw some familiar faces. A number of the robbers had left off robbing and become Franciscans themselves. The other Franciscan story happened long ago, less than 20 years after Francis's death. It had gradually become apparent to the powers of the world that members of an order which embraced poverty and renounced all hope of worldly gain were an ideal choice for diplomatic missions, even to other cultures who might reject their doctrine but would recognize their holiness. Francis himself had gone to see the Sultan of Egypt to see if he couldn't end the Crusades by converting the Sultan to Christianity, and although the conversion didn't happen, the conversation did. In the 1240s, the entire world was under threat from a new power, the Mongols. The Mongols lived in large nomadic communities, drinking mare's milk and horse's blood according to season, and therefore needing no resource but grass. Central Asia is made of grass. The Mongols could gather an irresistible mobile fighting force just over the horizon and launch it against any civilized state anywhere, and they did. They could and did destroy whole cities and bring countries to a state of collapse. In 1245, a party of Franciscan friars went on a mission from the Pope to the court of the Mongol Khan. The mission was partly for diplomacy, partly for research because no one really knew who the Mongols were, and partly for evangelization. Their leader was 63 years old, and their journey on foot took a year. But it isn't the heroism of that that's so important. It is the fact that by doing the opposite of what embassies usually do, splendour, opulence, a fine show of power, they showed themselves as holy men, men worthy of respect, men worth protecting on their long journey and worth listening to when they arrived. From 1245, now to 2025. Some of you were kindly encouraging about the keynote address the Archdiocese of Southwark asked me to deliver at their day for catechists. You told me to tell you how it all went, so here is my report. The event was a sellout. 230 people came. There were people of all kinds from all over the diocese, and what struck me most was their energy. There are church events people go to because they can't think of anything better to do. This was not such an event, and these were not that kind of people. These were people determined to be missionaries within their own parishes and diocese, and not only to do missionary things like guidance, teaching, and inspiration, but also to make themselves better equipped for the job, becoming spiritually fitter, if you like. It was amazing and quite humbling. What could I possibly say to them that could live up to who they already were? I told them the story of Universalis from the beginning almost 30 years ago. I told them about Universalis as it is now and all the good they could do with it in confirmation groups, First Communion groups, and even for themselves. Then I told them about my book, The Creed in Slow Motion, and why I had written it and the kind of approach it took. They were a lovely audience, very responsive, and afterwards they so mobbed me with copies of the book for me to sign that by the time I got to the publisher's bookstall downstairs it had sold out. Every single copy had gone. Thank you all of you who offered encouragement or offered up prayers. I am by no means a professional speaker, but I enjoyed it, and so did the audience. So, thank you. There is a video of the event on YouTube, and you'll find a link to it in the episode notes for this podcast if you're interested. I don't know what that video is like, because I daren't watch it myself. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.